Okay, so the work that I'm going to speak about today, I've done together with, where is he? Here, Uli Zülicke from Victoria University in Wellington. And yeah, I'll speak about spins and pseudospins in graphene. So yeah, I have more worked on real spins, and yeah, when the pseudospins in graphene became popular, I wanted to understand in particular, yeah, what are commonalities and differences between those, and this will in a way make up today's talk. So yeah, the band structure of graphene is something well known, I guess, to most of you, that we get this linear dispersion, which is, yeah, this Dirac-like band structure, massless Dirac fermions is how we like to call this. And yeah, this reflects the honeycomb structure making up the graphene, which gives us this hexagonal band structure, a Brillouin zone, and the linear dispersion is really what we get here at the K points of the Brillouin zone. And you all know how we describe this with such a 2x2 Hamiltonian sigma dot k, sigma the vector of Pauli matrices, and this is what we call the pseudospin in the context of single layer graphene. The main focus of my talk today is really on bilayer graphene, where we are essentially duplicating the band structure of single layer graphene, only that here at the K point, we would have a fourfold degeneracy without interaction between the two honeycomb layers. So with the interaction between these layers taken into account, we get here such a sequence of three bands. The upper one, non-degenerate, this one here, twofold degenerate, and then splitting up, and once again, a non-degenerate band. And yeah, I just want to note here that these different bands reflect the different sublattices that make up the bilayer structure. So this band here corresponds to a superposition of orbital states from a sublattice A and A primed. So yeah, the gray atoms sublattice A, the red atoms sublattice B, and the unprimed ones, the upper layer, and the primed ones, the lower layer. And yeah, here this twofold degenerate band corresponds to B, B primed. These are here the staggered atoms in the bilayer structure. Yeah, and of course, this region here where conduction and valence band touch, this is what I will be interested in today. It's well known what the band structure, the Hamiltonian looks like, that we need to describe this structure. The K-linear terms are very small. The dominant term is this quadratic one here, and this quadratic one that gives us a simple parabola, once again, is a small one. So the dominant physics for the band structure really comes from this term here. Yeah, and if we do add electric and magnetic fields, first of all, we introduce a vector potential in the Hamiltonian, and then we get here a Zeeman-like term, an orbital Zeeman term. Then it's also been long known that a perpendicular electric field induces a band gap in the bilayer graphene. And then it's also been known for some time that we get such a mixed term here, proportional to both electric and magnetic field. And the interesting thing for my talk here today is that this Hamiltonian with electric and magnetic fields is essentially completely symmetric under an exchange of electric and magnetic fields. And yeah, essentially my talk will cover the issue that this symmetry under electric and magnetic fields is not just an accident, but this is what we must have in bilayer graphene for good reasons.
But also there's a vector potential.
So excuse me?
The vector potential, it kind of violates the symmetry in a sense?
The symmetry, I will speak about this in much more detail, only affects terms proportional to the fields and not terms proportional to the vector potential and scalar potentials. It's only, yeah, in terms that are appearing in the Hamiltonian that directly depend on the fields that we get this. Yeah, so just an example here for how an electric field perpendicular to the bilayer graphene gives us a tunable band gap in bilayer graphene. So if we have the bilayer graphene sandwiched here, for example, between the doped silicon substrate and a platinum top gate with some insulating silicon oxide and aluminum oxide in between, then these experiments showed that the electric field opens up a significant gap going up to a quarter of an electron volt. Similarly, we also get a splitting of the band with the magnetic field. The G factor characterizing the bilayer graphene is of the order of 6. So with a magnetic field of 10 Tesla, we get a gap of a few millielectron volt. So the outline of my talk is the goal is to understand the...
Why is the theory so smooth?
Excuse me?
Go back to the slide. Why does the theory not have sharp features in it? Shouldn't there be some sharp onset for interband transitions?
Oh!
Not broadening the theory or something?
I need to admit that this theory is not my own one. So I do know from my own calculations of such optical spectra that commonly, in order to compare with real spectra, you often put in some phenomenological broadening. And I can imagine, but this is now my wild guess, that they did something similar here to just get as close as possible to the overall feature of the experiments.
Sorry, simple question. Where does G about 6 come from?
It comes from the famous Chronzowski-Weiss-McClure Hamiltonian, which is essentially a tight binding Hamiltonian for the bilayer graphene band structure. And when we expand it here around the K point, keeping these four bands here, it gives us terms quadratic in K that describe here the dispersion. And then we also get terms in second order perturbation theory, which are proportional to the anti-symmetrized product of K, which essentially is the coupling to a magnetic field. It is ultimately the very same thing like when you have the Dirac equation and you boil it down in the low energy limit, which gives us a kinetic energy P squared over 2m and a Zeeman term, where the Zeeman term comes also from anti-symmetrized terms in momentum, in the kinetic momentum, including the vector potential. So, yeah, it is the standard model for bilayer graphene.
It's an orbit interaction, ultimately.
No. This is a purely orbital thing. In this case, it's a purely orbital thing.
I see.
There is.
So it's some kind of combination of the orbital energy, sort of short wavelength orbital.
It is an orbital Zeeman term. It's so far I have not spoken about real spins. They will come up later in the talk. So the approach that I want to use is based on a symmetry analysis and the so-called theory of invariance. Time reversal symmetry does play an important role here. One of the main conclusions will be that in a certain way, magnetic and electric fields turn out to be completely equivalent in bilayer graphene. And I'll have some conclusions at the end. So the theory of invariance is something that goes back to Russian scientists Beer and Pikus. I only found here this figure showing Pikus together with Emanuel Rushba, whom we know from the Rushba Hamiltonian. And in a way, Rushba himself has often employed very similar concepts that make up the theory of invariance. So the main idea is to construct. Left is Pikus, and on the right is Rushba. So, yeah. The main idea is that we want to construct a Hamiltonian in the most general way compatible with the symmetry of the bands that we are interested in. And the Hamiltonian here may depend on some general tensor operator, which may include the wave vector k, electric and magnetic fields, the real spin degree of freedom, strain fields, all kinds of perturbations that we might be interested in a very general fashion can be included here in the Hamiltonian. And the basic idea is that the Hamiltonian, with all these terms included, should always be invariant under all the different symmetry operations that make up the symmetry group of the problem we are interested in. So for each symmetry element, we get essentially such an invariance condition, and we try to construct the Hamiltonian compatible with these constraints, which first sounds a bit complicated, but essentially it boils down to being able to make an expansion of the full Hamiltonian where we have some symmetry adapted tensor operators times some symmetry adapted matrices. So in our case, this will just be the Pauli matrices. And each of these terms is then weighted with some expansion coefficients. I cannot go through all the details of such a calculation, but I want to give you at least a little bit of a flavor. Time reversal is also something that plays a role here, as I mentioned already. So in general, time reversal connects the states with a wave vector k and minus k. And then if we have the time reversed Bloch functions corresponding to k and minus k, they are often also linearly dependent for the time-reversed state and the state at minus k, so that the bottom line is, when we also take into account spatial symmetries connecting a k and minus k, that we get an additional constraint for the Hamiltonian that looks kind of similar to what I discussed before for the spatial symmetries. This is now a consequence of time reversal symmetry. Theta here is the time reversal operation, and the time reverse state, or in more precise terms, the the state with reverse motion is related to the state minus k, and it is typically such that the time reverse state that we get by applying the time reversal operator is a linear combination of the Bloch functions that we have at minus k. Here I have not included spin explicitly, but yes, in principle you do. You can include also the spin here with all the extra constraints. Then spin is also flipped and so forth. Yeah.
But here in this definition now, you do not include it.
I have not made it explicit, but our analysis that I'm going to include does take into account also the spin degree of freedom. So the details say how such a linear expansion looks like is then always a bit tricky and depends on how all the different Bloch functions are defined with all their phases and so on. These are very technical details.
So a dumb non-expert question. Why don't we do this program first for singular graphene? What is it, just because
Uli and I have done did this a couple of years ago, and then we thought let's also do it for bilayer graphene. Excuse me.
There's interesting aspects already for single.
Essentially that gave us all the different interactions that are possible. But I will come back to how. Our old findings for single layer graphene compare to those that we get for bilayer graphene. In a way, going from single layer to bilayer graphene resulted in a much more complete picture of how things work with electric and magnetic fields in these materials. I will come back to this.
Three layers, you're going to get the more insights somehow?
I doubt it that, maybe we can discuss once more the question when I have discussed the results in some more detail. So, the main ingredients of this symmetry analysis is that the crystal structure of the bilayer graphene is characterized by some crystal point group. Details do not matter so much, but when we have the Brillouin zone, the states at the different points in the Brillouin zone are then also characterized by some symmetry group. If we are at the center, the gamma point, the point group characterizing these states is the same that makes up the crystal structure itself. And if we are at the K point here, which is of interest to us, it is essentially a subgroup of this point group that will leave this wave vector K invariant, so that the bottom line is the Hamiltonian for the bilayer graphene at the K point, which is what we are interested in, has the symmetry d sub 3d, which is this subgroup of the full crystal point group. And it's kind of important here that this symmetry group only contains rotations and no inversion or reflection operations. So if we do now compare with single layer graphene, the point group then for the K point is d sub 3h, where the d sub 3 we have for bilayer graphene is a subgroup for what we have for the single layer graphene, so that this tells us immediately that in all the terms that one finds for single layer graphene are also allowed in a bilayer graphene plus more terms. So if we just look, for example, at the kinetic energy operator I'd shown you before, it's the very same Hamiltonian that we also get for single-layer graphene, only that the prefactors are very different. In a single-layer graphene, all the physics is dominated by the K-linear term, and for typical Fermi wave vectors, the quadratic terms are small, and in a bilayer graphene, it's just the other way around. The quadratic terms are important, and the K-linear term is a small correction. Yeah, and if we do this, the main result is really that in bilayer graphene, magnetic fields and electric fields are interchangeable in the sense that for every term in the Hamiltonian that we find proportional to the magnetic field, we have another valid term where the magnetic field is replaced by an electric field and vice versa. So for example, if we have a Zeeman term, S dot B, and here now the S is the real spin degree of freedom, we also get in bilayer graphene a term S dot electric field, and a Rajpa term, which looks like this in the single layer graphene case, we get a complementary term in bilayer graphene that is proportional to the magnetic field.
But the coupling constants, are they the same?
This is just what I want to say here. The prefactors that we get for such a term as compared to this one, or a Zeeman term and this electric Zeeman terms, the prefactors are in general unrelated with each other. There is no simple recipe that allowed us to predict one prefactor given the other one. So, in a qualitative sense, it is that we get a certain physics with a magnetic field, and we get essentially the same physics also with an electric field. I mean, there are more details to be discussed here that I will talk about further on. Yeah.
So this is for K. For K prime of the transition?
This is something, how K and K prime are related to each other is something that I'm going to talk about in a bit more detail later in this talk. Yeah.
For the previous slide, when you said this Hamiltonian, so you say small and large, what's the smallness there, like in A31 and A32? Is there some?
I mean, to some extent, certainly you're always comparing apples with oranges. For a K-linear term as compared to a quadratic term, say in bilayer graphene, when what was the density that we had? We were just looking at it yesterday. Something times 10 to the 10, 1 times 5 times 10 to the 10 per square centimeter is the density for bilayer graphene when the K-linear term and the K-quadratic term give you about equal contributions. Now, if you typically have a density that is one order of magnitude or yet more larger than 5 times 10 to the 10, then the quadratic term will just dominate the linear one. But if you push the limit of going to the Dirac point, then certainly all these things change. But for typical densities, it is the quadratic term dominating over the linear one. Yeah?
Yeah, stupid question, but why do I see that these terms here are ponderous with invariant?
It's not that straightforward to see, because time reversal always takes us from K to K prime. So the consideration of time reversal invariance is, in that sense, never that obvious here. One has to sit down a bit more carefully and work out all the relations between the Bloch functions at K and K prime in order to see that this is indeed the case.
So this representation is then around a K point.
Correct. Yeah. I have not yet explicitly included the K prime point.
Also, just a quick question.
Yeah.
What would be a minimal microscopic model that would give rise to all these terms? With just like a nearest neighbor, tight binding, or SSP orbit?
Tight binding has the general difficulty that you cannot easily include all kinds of external fields. This is a conceptual advantage, in my opinion, of the theory of invariants.
No, but
yeah.
Sure, but then the still question, how do you go about it microscopically?
Microscopically, it is very difficult. I have also spoken with people like Jaroslav Fabian about this, who is doing these very fancy ab initio calculations. In these calculations, it is possible to include certain types of fields. So we can include a electric field perpendicular to the sheet, because we have broken translational invariants anyway, but we cannot include an electric field in plane, and with a magnetic field, it's just the other way around, where we have the vector potential. We can have a vector potential that is perpendicular, corresponding to an in-plane magnetic field, but the G factor, say, that I extracted with this, it's really K dot P type calculation to get the G factor for a perpendicular magnetic field in a direct calculation is very difficult to extract
the
from.
G factor is strongly anisotropic, I suppose.
Yeah. It's completely. An electric field in the ab initio type of calculations, you can easily include an electric field out of plane and a vector potential out of plane. But the vector potential out of plane corresponds to an in plane magnetic field.
What about K dot P? Can you actually get the coefficients?
Oh, yeah. I don't have them here, but starting from something like a standard Schlonsovsky, Weiss, McClure, Hamiltonian, you can, for these coefficients that just describe the dispersion, you can derive the prefactors in much the same way like we're used from standard semiconductors, where we have a more complete picture in terms of something like the Kane-Hamiltonian, which we then project on the subspace of electrons or holes and get the effective masses and the effective g-factors and so forth. This is conceptually very similar.
Now, the equivalence you just mentioned, is it in contrast to the minimal coupling that you have here, for instance? Can you just
What you call minimal coupling?
Just change P into P minus U is CA. Because apparently the equivalence is only between the
two. It's the very same thing. So essentially, when you do the perturbation expansion, you get terms that, I would write, as some symmetrized product of the wave vector component, and you get something that is the anti-symmetrized product of your wave vector components, which is then really IJK proportional to the magnetic field. If the K is here, your kinetic momentum, and this is exactly the same way how you get Zeeman term from the Dirac equation and all. It's always the same thing. When you have a multi-band model that you boil down, you get symmetrized and anti-symmetrized terms. Okay, so, so I said the prefactors are unrelated, and quite generally, this magneto-electric equivalence refers to terms in the Hamiltonian explicitly dependent on the fields. Whereas, the terms that depend on the scalar and vector potential are not included in this magnetoelectric equivalence. Yeah.
Could you tell me in the last pattern, what do this S and sigma stand for? Sigma is the pseudo spin?
No. S is really, throughout my talk, is the real spin, and sigma is the pseudo spin corresponds to the conduction and valence band that we described with the Dirac-like Hamiltonian.
I don't see why you call it Rashba, because it is, Rashba is really like a K cross sigma something.
It is essentially the lowest order term that we get in an expansion where an electric field induces some spin splitting. In that sense, yeah, also one can say, that's why. I just want to briefly remind you, this is kind of instructive, why normally we have only a Zeeman term, but no term S dot E, and that helps us to understand here the physics. So this has to do, first of all, with spatial symmetries, that both the spin and a magnetic field are axial vectors. So S dot B is a scalar and therefore allowed, whereas electric field is a polar vector. So S dot E is a pseudoscalar, which changes sign under inversion and is therefore forbidden normally. I told you that the symmetry group, the crystallographic point group characterizing the K point, only contains rotations, and therefore there is just no distinction anymore between polar and axial vectors in the crystal structure of bilayer graphene, and therefore S dot E is allowed in bilayer graphene. And the second thing we need to look at is time reversal, that S and magnetic field are both odd under time reversal, so that S dot B is even and therefore allowed, whereas electric field is even, and therefore S dot E is odd and is forbidden. And now we have once again this a point I mentioned before, that time reversal really maps K onto K primed. And then I've just put here a few dots because I'm skipping over some more technical arguments, where the bottom line is that S dot E becomes allowed at the K point of bilayer graphene. And for this argument, the multi-valley band structure of bilayer graphene is really crucial. And we can keep going. Graphene is a paramagnet, so you could argue that only a time reversal breaking magnetic field can create a macroscopic spin polarization, a magnetization. So how can we then have a term S dot E allowed in bilayer graphene? And this is now the point where the valleys of bilayer graphene enter the picture. If we have the term S dot magnetic field, this term orients the spins in the same way in both valleys, so that with a magnetic field, we are indeed inducing a true spin polarization, a macroscopic one. So this hexagon illustrates the Brillouin zone at K and K prime point. The spins are pointing in the same direction. S dot E is such that the spins are oriented anti-parallel in both valleys. And if I look then at the macroscopic structure, averaged over all spins, the electric field does not induce a magnetization. But the interesting thing was pointed out to us by Markus Morgenstern. If you do something like a spin resonance, where you're just inducing transitions between the split states, it does not really matter whether all spins are pointing in the same direction or half of the spins are split in one way and the other half of spins is split oppositely. So one can do here essentially something like electric field induced ESR.
So Roland,
yeah,
this is basically like a spin valley polarization,
right? Yes. That the valleys are spin polarized in the opposite way.
So this Norbert effect in the flat bilateral graphene, have they been observed? Any of this Norbert effects?
The effects are certainly not very large. This was how I got into touch with Jaroslav Fabian, who has studied these effects with ab initio DFT calculations. And the effects are not completely negligible, but ultimately we are talking about carbon and the numbers are small. Yeah.
So my question still has any of these effects been observed?
The things that we have predicted here, no.
But could be observed. In principle,
yes.
Not say, that so bad that you would say impossible, still there's hope to observe.
Say something like ESR is certainly a very sensitive technique, that even though the effects are small that we are talking about here, we also have an experimental technique that is rather sensitive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It can also be used as a tool because you can use now EDSR to manipulate your spin. So it would be
to
look for resonances response.
Yeah. Yeah, certainly.
A similar effect actually also find in the carbon nanotubes.
Mm-hmm.
Right, but then the curvature is pretty sharp, so that helps, right?
Well, one other question is about the spin orbit. So, Fakir Guinea and so on, they have this argument that the bilateral graphene should have huge spin orbit problems. And Jaroslav Fabian thinks is actually not true.
Yeah.
So,
from a different perspective, this theory of invariance, which is based on symmetry arguments, is conceptually very nice in order to tell you qualitatively which effects do exist and which effects do not exist. You need to complement this either with experiments. So what Beer and Pickles developed years and years ago has really been the starting point for many experiments on standard semiconductors that you know what phenomenologically to expect and then make comparison with experiment and theory. Or you need some other theory beyond the symmetry analysis to learn more about the prefactors.
Okay, so that is kind of obvious, right?
Yeah.
Still, the question is based on your expertise in this field.
Yeah.
What are you saying?
Yeah, you're the spin orbit guy.
The effects are small. There is no.
You would bet on the side of Fabian then.
Yeah. it's interesting once more to compare also with the pseudo spins. I've been talking now mostly about real spins. So pseudo spins are such that a magnetic field acts anti-parallel in both valleys. So this is opposite to what the electric field is doing. Which essentially means that a magnetic field cannot distinguish the sublattice, whereas the electric field acts in parallel in both valleys, essentially the electric field breaks the sublattice symmetry. So the bottom line here is that in an interesting way, the response of the real spin degree of freedom and of the pseudospin to the external fields is really opposite. The magnetic field polarizes the real spins, but not the pseudospins, and the electric field polarizes the pseudospins, but not the real spins. And then you can still wonder, how is this compatible with time reversal symmetry? And yeah, I'll come back to this question at the end of my talk. So here I just want to compare now with what Uli and I had done previously for single layer graphene. So this is just a table of different terms that we found induced by either a magnetic or an electric field. We have in single layer graphene an orbital Zeeman term. So sigma z is the orbital spin, and tau z here finally is the valley pseudospin. So the orbital spin is opposite in the two valleys. We also have a real spin with perpendicular and in-plane fields. We have Rushbaugh split-ins, and we also have such trigonal terms. And in bilayer graphene, we are essentially making this table complete, that for each term with a magnetic field, we have a complementary term with an electric field. And it's now such for every row that we have here. If one field acts in parallel in both valleys, then the other field will act in anti-parallel in the two valleys. So here the orbital Zeeman term is anti-parallel with the magnetic field and parallel with the electric field, and the spin Zeeman term is just opposite in E and B. Yeah. I want to come back to this question of pseudospins and discuss how they behave. So for the in-plane motion in single-layer graphene, we just have this Dirac Hamiltonian giving us the famous Dirac cones. For the bilayer graphene quadratic NK, we get the parabolic dispersion. The Z component of this pseudospin is related to the sublattice degree of freedom. So pseudospin Z up or down in single layer graphene corresponds to the sublattices A and B. And in bilayer graphene, it corresponds to B and B primed, if we are just interested here in these states. So with sigma X, Y, sigma Z, all three of them put together, we get here the SU2 algebra of pseudospin. And such SU2 algebras, as you probably know, are quite ubiquitous in physics. So we certainly have it for spin angular momentum. And then we have all kinds of other examples. Nuclear isospin is famous. The two-dimensional isotropic harmonic oscillator gives us such an SU2 algebra as a dynamical symmetry. All kinds of two-level systems, graphene, persistent spin helix, and many other examples, they all give us the SU2 algebra. These are now all pseudospins, and the question is whether we somehow can distinguish between real spins and pseudospins. And I wouldn't ask this question if there was indeed a way to do this related to time reversal symmetry, reversal of motion. So just a brief reminder what this means in general. If we have the Schrödinger equation and time reversal invariance, then the wave function is a function of plus t, and its complex conjugate is a function of minus t, are both solutions. And this is described by the time reversal operator, which is an anti-unitary operator that can be written as a product of complex conjugation times a unitary operator. And then we know that...
So Roland, you don't have to have a unique time reversal operator.
No, no.
That doesn't have to be... Okay.
When I choose a particular basis that gives me the particular U that I get, and when I go into a different basis, I will need a different U, but ultimately it's all time reversal that I describe that way. But there is no unique way of making this expansion of theta in terms of U and C.
Also, it can be that, I mean, like, if you have another unitary symmetry, then you can have two anti-unitary operators that simultaneously the anti-unitary.
Yeah, I can well imagine that. So in any case, observables are even or odd under time reversal. So position is even, and momentum and angular momentum are odd. And it is also well known that for the orbital motion, we have theta squared being plus 1. And for Dirac spin, theta squared is minus 1. So for a spin, 1/2 degree of freedom, we have to apply time reversal operation 4 times in order to fully get back what we started out with. And here it's quite illuminating to study one particular example with this pseudospin SU2 symmetry, which is the two-dimensional isotropic harmonic oscillator. So if we drop all the prefactors, px squared plus x squared plus py squared plus y squared, and that gives us 3 invariants besides the energy. One essentially corresponding to the z component of angular momentum, the difference in energy between the x and the y component of the motion, and the third one corresponding to the phase difference in the x and y component of the motion. So these 3 operators, you can easily convince yourself, give us here an SU2 algebra, discussed very nicely here in all these different sources, including, in particular, I like to emphasize Goldstein's book on classical mechanics. So this is kind of a hint that this is not really a quantum phenomenon here related to the real spin degree of freedom. And the surprising thing now is that if we just look at these 3 invariants, the first one is certainly odd under time reversal, but the other 2 here are even under time reversal. So we do have an SU2 algebra, but in a way, a funny one, where one component is distinguished from the other 2 with their behavior under time reversal symmetry, which in a way is not completely a surprise. As I told you, time reversal is anti-unitary, so this certainly goes beyond SU2, which by definition only talks about unitary symmetries. So in general, the SU2 algebra gives us 2 possibilities. We can have all 3 components odd under time reversal, which is what we get for real spins, but it is likewise compatible with the commutator relation of the generators, that only one component is odd and the other 2 components are even. And this is really what one finds for all the different pseudospin degrees of freedom. So the 2D harmonic oscillator, the difference between X and Y oscillator quanta is even. For nuclear isospin, reversal of motion, still the proton and neutron remain proton and neutron. This is even under time reversal. And for the graphene, the sublattice degree of freedom is certainly also invariant under time reversal of reversal of motion. So if we look at the half-integer representations of SU2, we have essentially these 2 possibilities. that the time reversal operator can be such that theta squared gives us minus one, a fermionic type of behavior, or theta squared gives us plus one, a bosonic behavior. And in that sense, now the pseudospin sublattice polarization that we do get from such a term, electric field dot sigma z, is in the end consistent with time reversal symmetry also. Yeah, and with this, I just want to conclude here. Yeah, just want to remark maybe that this equivalence of magnetic and electric fields can be found not only for the bilayer graphene, but any other materials with the same symmetries give us the same physics. So some kind of metamaterials or cold atoms in optical lattices may give us extra possibilities to tune the relative magnitude of these interactions beyond what we have in the particular case of bilayer graphene. Okay.
I think we all agree with your calculations. It's very careful. But can you just tell us what kind of bilayer graphene sample you need to prepare in order to observe your effect? For example, sample mobility, and whether it's suspended or on substrate, and where is the Fermi energy?
The possibilities to observe these effects is, first of all, something where Uli and I are still working on. So it is, first of all, conceptually this result that we do have this equivalence of electric and magnetic fields realized. And I have not yet detailed strategies available for how one best should set up experiments. So I did like very much, in particular, this idea about doing ESR with both magnetic and electric fields. But I do not yet know either what are the numbers one may expect to see in such experiments.
So is it enough to have a symmetry in the system, or do you also need, because I think we need a pseudo spin, we need to have a different, or if you want pseudo vector and vectors which are differently responding, or, so that's a question here. Is it,
I mean,
you have only spin the system because you have over the valley and
the symmetries. When I talk about it that way, I would say it is the symmetry of the crystal structure. So I have the symmetry of the bilayer graphene, where I can then characterize the states throughout the Brillouin zone by their symmetry, and then I do find at the K point of a system with this crystal structure, I do have generically realized such twofold degenerate states that behave in such a way. So whether I build the bilayer graphene-like structure out of carbon atoms or with some metamaterials, cold atoms, you like it, whatever you like best, will in that sense give you the same physics.
A related question to that. I mean, it seems to me that all these pseudo spin notions, they make sense in the low energy sector. And at some point, you might wonder, you know, when you go to higher and higher energies, whether those spins are still well defined or whether there are additional pseudo spins entering the system. Is that
I mean, essentially, I would say this is just a Taylor expansion about the K point of the dispersion, and it is at least conceptually just a question of how many terms I include in this Taylor expansion, for how far, as long as I do not have other bands entering the picture. So as long as I'm just roughly speaking interested here in these two bands making up the bilayer graphene, the famous Slonjovsky-Weiss-McClure Hamiltonian that now includes these other bands gives me a 4x4 matrix. The theory of invariance works much the same way, that I can then also in this 4x4 Hamiltonian include these extra terms and see what I get. So
what I mean is, yeah, that you have also outside of that subspace, you have bands, and those might respond, for example, more strongly to an electric field than the one which you're looking at. So when you calculate now, for example, the coefficients, mm-hmm, coupling constants of your terms, but you ignore now the outside bands, are you still sure that you will get then the right order of magnitude?
I mean, the physical idea is certainly that the physics that we are interested in is characterized by some Fermi energy and takes place in the vicinity of this Fermi energy. If I come along with, say, optical excitations with photon energies that are so large that I induce then transitions to remote states within this picture, then I'm certainly in trouble. Conceptually, I can extend this to as many bands as I like, similar to what we have in standard semiconductors. Normally, we work with the Kane model that just contains the valence band and the lowest conduction bands of our standard semiconductors. And if I do experiments in a range that the other states get relevant, I can extend it, include more bands, and in that sense, I'm not limited in the number of bands. And qualitatively, this does not change the picture. So, yeah.
I mean, you know this, and you know when you in the semiconductor, when you look at the contribution from the valence band,
uh-huh,
you mean, you know, you can change your G factor.
Essentially, we are doing a Taylor expansion, and in that sense, I would always argue we can get higher order terms in the expansion, but the when we have an effective mass corresponding to a quadratic term, this is just the prefactor, and this effective mass by itself does not change as long as, no matter what I'm doing in that context.
But what he means is different, I think. It's just like the correction that you just mentioned of the effective mass. You can change it big time, even the curvature.
Yeah.
But still be working in a subspace for the, you know, your low energy, but then have to correct by hand the effective mass. That's what we all do.
But in what kind of scenario? This is what I'm missing.
Whatever you're measuring, even if you're at AEF, you have to include corrections to high lying bands to fix the mass, for instance.
No.
If you're
no.
8x8, the mass is wrong. You have to go to 14x14.
No. The mass is just the prefect of the quadratic term, and that's it.
Sure, but you have to take it from somewhere.
No.
You just chose now an example which is good for you. But if I'm talking about G factor, then certainly you can be influenced by other bands.
Okay. We can discuss this further.
Yeah. Okay, let's move on then to the next speaker. Let's thank Rosenthal.